Welcome to Sanity, a podcast by the New York Sun. My name is A.R. Hoffman, and every week, along with my co-host Rebecca Sugar, we try to make sense out of the nonsense and bring a little bit of sanity to your week.
The quote of the week this week is from Whitney Tilson, a Democratic mayoral candidate.
Man of the hour.
Who appeared on stage last night at the debate, and he said something so great. He said, "We need to make crime illegal." And he said it, I won't give him credit, he said it tongue-in-cheek.
Actually a great line.
Yeah, he did say, I shouldn't have to say this. But the insane thing is that he did have to say it at the Democratic mayoral debate because it's not obvious to most of the people on that stage.
Yeah, short and sweet. I like it.
Yeah.
Okay, so we have a full program today. We'll start off with our top stories and we'll debrief the mayoral debate that happened on Wednesday night. We'll make it make sense section. We'll talk about deportations, visas, some drama with a new policy about immigration from certain bespoke countries. Our tipping point, we're going to touch on both some of the latest drama with Israel and Europe, as well as the very real drama between the world's richest man and the world's most powerful man, Elon Musk and Donald Trump. So, Rebecca, did you watch the debate? What are your reactions?
I did watch it.
I can tell the enthusiasm from your voice.
I feel like I want those 2 hours back, but maybe not, because I actually was amused in a sort of tragic way. So many takeaways. The first one is, you can divide this into what was said and what was not said, what was the issues that were raised and the issues that were not raised. I think the number one takeaway for me was that there were two candidates that clearly stood out to me. If I were just going in blank and watching this thing and trying to decide if I were a primary voter in this mayoral race.
Which many American, New Yorkers might have been, right?
Yeah,
I wonder
who's just watching it and saying, gee, who should I vote for? If I were that kind of person, I would have watched that. And I clearly would have voted for Whitney Tilson and even Michael Blake. And I'd say I disagree with Whitney Tilson, me personally, on probably 60% of his policies, and I probably disagree with Blake on 95% of the things that he said, but they came across as self-possessed and having a view and being sort of sources of strength. The two top contenders, Cuomo and Zohran Mamdani, who's hot on his tail, were, to me, underwhelming. Andrew Cuomo appeared not to be present fully. He just wasn't trying very hard, and he was getting dinged on things he shouldn't have been dinged on. Zohran Mamdani, who has so much reporting about him, and there's such a narrative about him, I was expecting such charm and such eloquence, and I didn't get either. Mm-hmm. He's really, I thought, sort of hype and nothing more. Mm-hmm. I want to say the questions were super interesting in that the very first one and the dominant theme I felt throughout was affordable housing. Mm-hmm. But number two and right on its tail was Donald Trump. Donald Trump was the 10th person on that stage, metaphorically. The entire gang of nine were just constantly weaving into their conversations ways in which they would fight Trump. Trump is the end of democracy, all the things we would expect. And then, the obvious stuff about crime and making New York, ensuring that it remains a sanctuary city, that was all there. What I thought was really interesting was what was not mentioned either in the questions or in the answers were the two things that make the Democrats the most ridiculous, and perhaps they've just learned some kind of lesson. I did not hear anything about gender-affirming care once as an aside. Mm-hmm. Now, maybe it came up one other time, but really it was not a dominant theme, nor was racism. Mm-hmm. These were the two calling cards of this party for the last, I don't know how many years, certainly the last four. They were almost not in the conversation. So that's good news, I guess, for the rest of us, but surprising because I didn't think that they had learned that lesson. DEI, I didn't really hear it come up very much either. Mm-hmm. So I would say that this is a group of people who I don't want to see any of them as the mayor of New York. One of them likely will be. Eric Adams, of course, is now running as an independent. He wasn't there. He also wasn't mentioned often. The real sparring was between Cuomo and Mamdani.
Yeah. That's a great rundown, Rebecca. It looks like a two-person race. It looks like a Cuomo-Mamdani race, and I thought you really hit the nail on the head with, it's kind of like the has-been versus the meme, you know, is one way to think about it. You know, Cuomo, it just shows you that politics, and we certainly know this after Biden, to some extent is a young person's game. And we've seen now multiple times in debates, older candidates who are not used to answering tough questions, who are not used to really being in the arena, which Biden was even though he was president, really struggle to perform in these settings. It reminded me a little bit, it wasn't quite as bad, but when Mayor Bloomberg ran for president and was in that debate and just—
Although he had such an obvious mistake moment, Bloomberg. Cuomo didn't have a terrible moment that I could identify.
Yeah, but it just felt a little bit like stiff. And so I think that was one thing to kind of clock, is that this isn't Cuomo in his prime, you know, years ago. Yeah. This is an older, in some sense, more battered candidate. And certainly the other candidates were battering him and ganging up on him. So it's clear he's the front runner. You know, I've been saying that I think Mamdani has a real shot here. Now,
you predicted last week that AOC would,
that she now has,
right, endorse him, and she has.
So she's come in behind him. I wished Cuomo looked a little stronger. But I will say, I don't think he totally screwed up. Mm-hmm. You know, I don't think he self-destructed. And one argument for his whole campaign is he's doing just enough, right? And sort of just enough not to lose. Now, whether that's enough to win will be another story entirely.
Yeah, I think that's right. I just want to correct myself. He did have a bad moment, not as bad as that Bloomberg moment. But when he was asked, they were all asked what their biggest political regret was. And he just launched into a list of all the political regrets about his party, but he couldn't come up with one about himself. He did duck and weave a lot throughout the night. Mm. Most politicians do, but he was sort of, you know, exceptional at it last night. But no, he didn't have like a devastating moment. But if you're afraid about Mamdani's rise, and a lot of people are, this didn't help Cuomo. Mm-hmm. I think the only thing that helped Cuomo is that Mamdani didn't help himself. Mm-hmm. If he hadn't gotten the AOC announcement today, I wonder what I would have said about him last night. I can't remember anything he said. It was just really not interesting.
And he had, I think it was Tilson who actually kind of scored him on him, won on him when he, you know, he had that line about Obama being the lesser of two evils.
Yes.
And, you know, that was kind of like
he called him evil, actually.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. A kind of body blow a little bit, but just showed that, you know, this is a really young and experienced and ideological candidate.
Right. And interesting, too, who each candidate was asked something along the lines of which politician in their party they most respect or align with or something. And the answers were interesting. I mean, Cuomo picked Hakeem Jeffries, who right now is not exactly,
kind of a strange choice.
Blazing a trail.
Right. I mean, it's a strange kind of like you think of, you know.
Who did that appeal to?
I mean, Hakeem Jeffries is, you know, I mean, and you could do worse. And at The Sun, we sort of have a fondness
for say Ilhan Omar.
Hakeem,
but I mean.
Or you could have said his father.
And then sadly, Whitney Tilson said Cory Booker, which I can't imagine how anybody could admire.
I just saw
that
Cory Booker is now writing a book about his filibuster. Did you see this? It's like where I
as
stand.
If the filibuster were
can
long
you imagine,
enough.
Can you imagine? Or just print the filibuster. I mean, talk about self-perpetuating.
But in fairness to these Democrats, I mean, who could they pick that would have been a positive answer? And there isn't exactly a great field out there of inspiring Democratic politicians.
It's such a strange field right now in terms of mayor's race because you have Adams who's kind of hanging in there, you know, and sort of the mayor, but as you said, kind of being ignored, right, running as an independent.
Well, they pitched him as Trump's puppet, if they pitched him at all. He barely was mentioned.
Right. And then, of course, you have this sort of strangeness of Cuomo as himself under criminal investigation, as is Letitia James. I have a piece on this today, who hates Cuomo maybe even more than she hates Trump.
Right.
Which
is really one of the best reasons to get Cuomo elected, because he's just not playing nice with all the Democrats. So it wouldn't be one solid wall of resistance to Trump. There's opportunities to break this thing up a little bit.
Right.
And
I've just said, you know, I mean, who knows? And, you know, we like Curtis Sue at The Sun. But, you know, if the Republicans had a stronger candidate, I think, you know, I think a Democrat obviously has an overwhelming advantage in New York, but one could see the outlines of a credible campaign, I think.
Yeah.
I also think there's a lane that's not really being occupied here. That's sort of not Cuomo, but also not Mamdani, like a sort of center left. And those candidates are like, I don't know, like the Bradlanders and this guy. I mean, they're kind of like
Bradlanders. Disqualifying from his opening statement where he sounded like a game show host. Like he's just so inauthentic. It's impossible to get behind him. I think that center left candidate would have been Whitney Tilson, but he just hasn't climbed in the polls. And also just interesting, you know, the subjects that come up, the questions are always the interesting thing. And e-bikes took up several minutes. And I thought, that's a major issue in New York. I had no idea. It's funny what they care about. And also really to note, and this is probably true of every, you know, on all sides of the political aisle in these debates, like the non-answers, right? What would you do to fix education? We need better education. What would you do to fix the subway problem? We need more police. Didn't you say defund the police? We need more police. I mean, there was no
which you'd hope on a local level, at least you'd get a little more detail, right? On a presidential level, you kind of expect that hot air, but you'd like to see someone with a grasp of kind of the actual levers of policy. Right. One thing I do hope is that whoever wins keeps Jessica Tisch as police commissioner.
Most of them said they would. Most raised their hand when asked that question.
Yeah. She'd have my vote for mayor. But
Okay,
let's go to Make It Make Sense. And we have lots of news this week about immigration policy. I think we were talking off camera about the deportation or attempted deportation of the family of the Boulder, Colorado attack. And we haven't, I think, gotten a chance to speak on this program about it. But, I mean, just absolutely horrific.
The attack, not the deportation.
Yeah, you know, just the attack. I mean, you know, and maybe that's sort of where we should start here.
Right.
It's just gruesome and appalling. And coming on the heels of the murders in D.C. suggests, you know, connect the dots, as the saying goes, suggests there is a real problem now with anti-Semitic violence coming from the far left or free power, whatever we want to call it.
Right.
You know, this is now an issue.
How about just acknowledging, I mean, here in New York, we had somebody set on fire in a subway train. Now we have people being set on fire in Boulder, Colorado. Just even if you remove the anti-Semitism from this, if you possibly can, in America in 2025, we live in a society where there are people among us who think it's okay to set people on fire.
Yeah.
It feels medieval. Yeah. I feel like we're talking about some other place and some other time. And so something about just that needs to be worked on culturally, and not just through our immigration policy, but also through our immigration policy.
Yeah, you're right. This kind of, you know, stochastic violence is the phrase for it. These eruptions of just gruesome violence and harm.
Yeah.
And you're absolutely right, medieval. And, you know, it needless to say, this is what globalizing the Intifada looks like, right? This kind of just license for real violence. And I think I mentioned it last week.
Well, is it fair to say also, you tread on thin ice when you say it, but it's true that, you know, people come from cultures where that kind of outburst is not unusual or even maybe looked upon with as medieval.
Yeah.
And so when you import them to your country, why wouldn't they behave the way they would? I mean, Soleimani was from Egypt.
Yeah.
You know, violence in the streets is not anathema there. And this kind of brutality is not something that everyone would be terribly, probably happened three times in the last month in Egypt, and we just don't know about it. Or at least you could imagine it could have.
Yeah.
Whereas in this country, we used to imagine it couldn't happen. And now I think we're starting to see people set a light in our streets, and we're shocked, but we're a little less shocked each time in a sad and twisted way.
Yeah, I thought that's a good point. I thought a little differently about the context, and that is the sort of rhetoric and claims from the press and elsewhere that seem to me to have given license to this kind of thing, like marinating in these claims of how awful Zionists are and how evil Israel is and baby killers and the way in which you kind of soak these toxins up. And it springs these kinds of assaults.
Right. But it releases impulses in people that maybe already pre-exist. And those impulses that pre-exist come from a certain way of living or a culture that already nurtures that. You don't see a lot of these
people are homegrown. I mean, but you're absolutely right. It's this incursion of this very dark.
Right. I mean, I've been really angry about things, and I've never thought to burn anybody alive.
Yeah.
Right.
But I think part of it is not to draw too. Put too fine a point on it is, if you read that, Israel is going to kill 14,000 babies in the next 48 hours, and then you hear that, 30 Gazans have been executed lining up for food, both of those were lies. Mm-hmm. The range of behavior that feels appropriate is going to expand. Right?
Yes.
And of course, there's an individual choice there.
Yes.
For sure. But this is a dangerous atmosphere.
The choice is
to. Yes,
you're right. And the choice is to take that out, though, on people who have nothing really to do with the thing that bothers you. And there are plenty of people who pick up and get on planes and go to the place to help save the people they're so concerned about. But they don't make that choice. They make the choice to create more death and destruction. Yeah.
So, in the wake of that, the administration announced its. Intention to deport his family, the accused, but now it's run into a roadblock in the form of the courts.
So legally, let's ask you these questions, which just came to my mind, which are, first of all, there was the issue of their overstaying the visa. Unclear to me if the children have separate visas, but the wife and the husband had visas and they overstayed them. Why wouldn't the wife, let's say, be just automatically deportable, whether or not her husband committed this horrible crime? Yeah. And what kind of due process is left if you already have issued a visa and she's overstayed it and you know that she's overstayed it?
Yeah, I mean, the order blocking the deportation is, as many of these are, temporary, pending further hearings. And so and this keeps
coming up. What's the hearing about?
Yeah, I mean, I think a lot of this is establishing these facts. And one of the questions is like, well, who gets to say, right? Like, do you need a judicial determination that, yes, this is when the visa began, this is when it ended, and sort of like a certificate? Or can the administration just do it on its say-so? And what we're seeing is increasingly it appears like judges are not willing to give the administration the benefit of the doubt, that they want to make these determinations themselves. Now,
but wait,
is that scalable?
I actually don't understand the point, because the visas are issued by our government. They have an end date. The government knows the end date. It's in the system. I mean, maybe the system's in a deep cavern like Elon Musk discovered, and so it's hard to find. But one assumes that you push a button and you can see the visa expired on this date. This woman is still in this country. That's illegal right there. Mm-hmm. What else needs to be determined in order to deport her? What do we need a hearing to go back and say, you need to prove that you've pushed the button and that the date has expired? I mean, it's already clear that that's true.
Yeah. I think the devil's in the details, and the attorneys for the family are sort of making all kinds of claims. But I think you're right. I mean, there's a kind of fundamental tension here of like, who gets to make this decision and how quickly can it get done?
Right.
And increasingly, it just feels like these decisions aren't being thought of judicially as the executives to make unilaterally.
Right.
And
then this question I had of, he was an Egyptian national, he lived in Kuwait. And then I think he applied for asylum here, and that's pending that decision. Mm-hmm. Well, if you're applying for asylum, shouldn't you apply for asylum in the first country next to the country you're fleeing? Wasn't that international law? Like, when did it become the standard that everybody who wants asylum from all over the world can fly all the way over here and request it, and then we're obligated to give it to them?
Yeah. Well, that would be unusual. I mean, the vast majority of asylum claims obviously are those who came from the southern border, right? So this is their first kind of port of call.
Well, many of them come up through several countries before they reach. I mean, that was the whole issue with Mexico that Trump won was trying to work on. So. But this guy flew a plane over here to get here and then sought asylum. Yeah. What, is that legally?
While he was on his tourist visa and then overstayed the tourist visa. Yeah.
Okay. So I think a lot of us just sort of look at this mess and say, another hearing? We have to wait now for another judge.
Right.
And to your point, it's really about who gets to make this decision.
Yeah.
Right. And I just quickly on Trump's order about all these countries around the world. So we had this, of course, in his first term where he issued a ban on travel from from 9 countries, I think it was. And it was called a Muslim ban, even though it wasn't really. But that was adjudicated. They fought against it and in the courts. It was delayed. And then the Supreme Court voted in Trump's favor that it was okay to have those travel bans. So now that he's issued this, there are all the rumblings again. We're going to fight him in the courts. Well, can they? Isn't it already established that he can do this?
Yeah. I mean, so in the first term, remember, there were 3 different versions of this policy that were crafted with sort of increasing levels of refinement, let's say, to such the point that the Supreme Court eventually allowed it. I mean, I think this will be upheld. It seems rational enough, except that, you know, it was promulgated after the Colorado attack and it doesn't include Egypt.
Right.
But then again, you know, the executive has the power. They don't have to explain, you know, why something's on it. It just has to be, broadly speaking, generally applicable, not discriminatory, that kind of thing.
Right.
But you know, it's within the government's right to do this. I don't quite understand how the different categories were chosen. Maybe we'll hear more about that.
But so the prior Supreme Court ruling on this doesn't just anchor in his right to do it. He still has to go through.
No, it's precedent. I mean, it you know, it's a strong kind of like precedent that these kinds of orders are within the power of the president to make. So I think it will largely be upheld. Precisely because it doesn't feel like there's any rhyme or reason to it, which actually helps, right?
It's
like,
not
it doesn't
discriminatory
feel
against
discriminatory,
one group.
Right.
Yeah. Okay. All right. So so we can expect then, what's next for Soleimani's family? Like, what's the trajectory there? What steps do we have to go through?
It'll be a little bit like the Khalil case and some of these others where, you know, the Trump will be prevented from deporting him immediately. There'll be some kind of, you know, hearing, but it's really still unclear of like what due process is owed.
Mm-hmm.
You know, some process is. So we'll see that. And really the question will be, who has the burden of proof? And if the government has the burden of proof, you know, they'll have to argue that this makes sense. If the family has the burden of proof, you know, they might have a harder time staying in the country.
Okay. Turning point. Should we turn to
the
Elon Musk Trump BBB turning point moment?
Yeah, I mean, talk about like, you know, a bad breakup. And, you know, Musk called the bill an abomination, despicable. He's actively campaigning against it. Trump so far has been pretty restrained. I think the Republicans are trying to figure out like, okay, how do we deal with this? I mean, this man has the biggest megaphone on earth besides for Trump, maybe. And, you know, so we've seen congressional Republicans kind of say, well, you know, I don't really agree with Elon or whatever. But I mean, everyone said this, there was a blow up coming and here it is.
Right. How serious of a blow up do you think it is?
I don't think they'll be golfing anymore. You know, I mean, but what's interesting, I think, about this blow up is that it's really about policy. I mean, that's the thing. I don't think it's about personality. It's really about core issues of how should government spend? How should it operate? And we have, you know, on the one hand, you know, Trump's bill is kind of business as usual in Washington and, you know, has lots of – it adds to the deficit and has tax cuts and all that stuff. And Musk is coming from that kind of Silicon Valley mentality and is just like, this is a ginormous waste and I spent all this time saving some money and this blows it out of the water.
Right. Yeah, it seems to me that they're both right. Elon Musk is correct on the policy side, as you just laid out, and President Trump is sort of correct on the politics side. And, you know, if this doesn't pass, the tax cuts go away. It's sort of devastating to the economy, devastating to Trump's platform. So he feels up against a wall. He doesn't really have time to deal with the policy that Elon Musk is insisting on. They're both kind of right in their own lanes.
Mm-hmm.
And so maybe they can, you know, get together and play golf again and just sort of recognize that they're both up against a wall. I like kind of Senator Mike Lee, I think, said now that he's going to propose a constitutional amendment, like the Warren Buffett rule, that if GDP exceeds 3% or if the deficit exceeds 3% of the GDP, that, you know, every member of Congress would be ineligible for reelection.
Yeah.
There is a increasing understanding that we have to do something to stop Congress from just wildly spending and spending, because nothing stops them from spending. The only thing would be if it redounds back to their,
I mean, I think
negative.
I think there's, you know, this is a real divide in the Trump coalition. I mean, there are Republicans for whom tax cuts are the most important thing, and there's this kind of, you know, Doge tech side of the coalition that, you know, just looks at deficits and says this is unsustainable,
right.
You know, and has no patience
right.
for, right. you know, legislative deal making, has no patience for, you know, this kind of, right. as you said, the political elements of
it. I thought it was a bad moment, actually, for Speaker Johnson when he was asked about it. And he sort of said, you know, we've been working on this for 14 months. It's too late now. That's true, mm-hmm. right? But it's also the problem. And he just amplified it. You've been working on this for 14 months and it didn't occur to you or anybody else on the right or the left to do anything meaningful to attack this problem and to respond to the will of the American people. Even as Elon Musk was out there shining this huge spotlight on the problem, you still thought that you could increase the deficit rather than even keep it the same, let alone make it lower. And it's just the stunning, I don't know, ridiculousness of the Congress, of how it works. I'm sure if I were Elon Musk, I'd be equally disgusted by what I've seen. He's not a naive guy, but
And give him credit. I mean, he's really campaigning against this. I mean, he wants it to fail.
Right.
And, you know, this is very high stakes poker.
Right.
I mean, this is really shoving everything to the middle of
the
table.
And if he loses in that fight to make it fail, you wonder what could ever then change the way spending is done by Congress. We just went through Doge, and if that didn't get the public angry enough and get Congress scared enough to change their ways, what would?
Yeah, I mean, but, you know, when you see, you know, and Elon said this, he says, you know, I was pinching pennies, I was scraping pennies, and you hear $2 trillion added to the deficit. I mean, it's just, it's mind-boggling. We don't have a party of fiscal conservatism anymore.
No.
There's none. There's neither
doesn't
side.
Exist.
And whether it's, you know, Biden blowing out the economy with spending after COVID or this blowing out, it's just, we've lost any, you know, any guilt about it, even, right? I mean, there's no longer even a sense of of being a kind of responsible steward.
Yeah, that's what I mean. In this moment, it couldn't have been a greater moment to induce that sense of guilt or that sense of shame or fear. Nothing could do it more than Elon Musk and Doge and the news that it made. And it still didn't work. You have to be sort of realistic and say what you just said. We don't have fiscal restraint. It just doesn't exist, and it probably never will.
Yeah. Yeah. What do you think? Do you think the bill passes? Yes or no?
Yeah, I think it's going to pass, and there'll be like three more $9 billion rescission bills to make it look like they're eating away at the problem. I mean, I'm very happy to see federal funding leave PBS and all these other places that, didn't deserve
but that
it.
That argument's harder to make when they're spending at this level, right?
Right. It's not going to matter to the total number, but it still matters, meaning it still matters that those places don't deserve federal funding.
Yeah.
But they're going to just pile up three, four of them, maybe we'll get, $25 billion of rescission bills and they'll call it a win.
It's a close call. I mean, listen, it only passed the House by one vote, and then it has to go to the Senate, then back to the House. And, Elon just keeps turning up the heat. I think things could get pretty wild.
Yikes.
I really do. Okay. Our final section is our sunburn section. It's a sunlight, but more just a spotlight, let's say. And that is this extraordinary Ukrainian drone attack on the Russians. It just shows, and again, regardless of what you think, how the war should end, I think you have to admire the ingenuity, the planning. This is like, if Israel did this, it would be seen as like, another kind of classic instance of Israeli ingenuity. And Ukraine, I mean, to plant these drones in Russian territory for a year and a half and then activate them and destroy a huge part of Russia's, anti-aircraft force is just an astonishing achievement. And it just shows that necessity is the mother of invention. And we'll see how it changes the calculus. I don't know whether it, makes peace more or less likely. I'm not sure, but it shows that, Ukraine's really fighting for its life. And it's really, like David against Goliath.
Do you think they did it alone? Do you think it was a purely Ukrainian operation?
Well, there were some great quotes where Europe's like, well, maybe we should be taking notes from Ukraine. I don't know. Maybe they had help from the inside. I don't know.
I just noted that Zelensky said in his remarks afterwards, he was very careful to say, we did this all by ourselves, which tells me we didn't do this all by ourselves.
Yeah. Who do you think was in on it?
NATO.
Maybe.
Mike Pompeo's there. There's a lot of chatter about that. What's he doing there? Lindsey Graham was just there.
Maybe.
It's not inconceivable that they
had help. Yeah. Cool.
That's your sunlight? I just rained on your sunlight a little.
That's
sorry.
Okay. Okay.
My sunburn is, we haven't talked on this show about the Diddy trial.
Mm-hmm.
And then it sort of felt like just more, ugly celebrity gossip. And then the Glenn Greenwald tape came out this week, and that just felt ugly again. And I have sadly watched a lot of this stuff. I don't know why I'm sort of riveted by it. And it's truly ugly. It's ugliness. I don't know what else to call it. Mm-hmm. It's real dirt. But I think what I took away from it, and I think matters about it, is that the human degradation that is delivered onto others and onto oneself in these videos and in the testimony in the trial is so overwhelming and shocking and sad and just ugly, I guess, that one has to wonder, from a legal point of view, so far what we've seen with the Diddy stuff and with the Glenn Greenwald tape is that, the issue of consent is brought up a lot. So far, the Diddy stuff is really not a lot of the criminal stuff. It's just the ugliness of these parties and what he did to his girlfriend and what he did to other people consensually. And it's disgusting. And to hide behind the idea of consent is to maybe miss the larger point that there's a real moral failing here in our society as a whole. And these people are just reflecting it back to us. And so, no, Glenn Greenwald shouldn't, lose his job because he has strange proclivities. But you can't unsee what you saw and unknow what you now know. And there's something deeply broken about people who degrade themselves that way and then videotape it. And there's obviously so much that's degrading about what Diddy did and all the people who knew about it and said nothing about it and who may have even thought that that's the way wealthy, music moguls behaved. And so a little moral judgment, maybe not commingled with the law, but in us and in society, I think is called for here. I don't want to sound pious or anything. I just want to say we can't expose ourselves to this kind of degradation and not have some kind of human moral reaction that resists it.
And on that note, very well said, be sure to listen to our interview with Mark Gerson on Sunday, where he his great new book, God Was Right, and touches on how we live with dignity and how we learn how to be better.
Right.
So look forward to
Send one to Diddy and to Glenn.
Right. Thanks, Rebecca.